Matthew chapter 5. We're in the second week of our series, Eight Things That I Wish Jesus Had Never Said. And last week we looked at persecution, that Jesus told us that we're blessed when we're persecuted. And the word blessed means I'm happy when I'm persecuted. That's our challenge from God, is that when we are persecuted, when we're dealing with insults and we're dealing with put downs from the world around us, that is, we should take that as a badge of honor. That we take that as something to be proud of and blessed by and happy by. Today we're looking a little bit further in Matthew chapter 5, and we're going to talk about adultery. It's not something that we often talk about, but Jesus makes a very interesting point here in Matthew chapter 5 about what it is and about how we can avoid it and how we can move away from it. And it's one of those things that for a lot of guys and even for a lot of girls, we look at ourselves and we apply an Old Testament point of view to our actions and our whether or not we're sinning, when Jesus actually set up something much, much different than what the Old Testament said. And we're going to look at that today. So today, the second thing I wish Jesus had never said is that checking out somebody other than your spouse is adultery. So when does a relationship progress to a point that we could label as adultery? Is it when there's actual a physical relationship outside of the bonds of marriage? Is it just a kiss? Is it an intimate conversation? Or is it something else entirely? What point is that? Let's read what Jesus said about it. Matthew chapter 5, verse 28. Let's start in verse 27, actually. Sorry. He said, "You have heard it said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." So we need to kind of walk through verse 28. We're going to define some terms, because I think if we don't look at what the words that Jesus said, what they actually mean, we're going to miss part of what Jesus' point is for this. And there's application. He's speaking about men, but there's application in this to men and to women and to people who aren't married and to everybody, to people who are married. Everybody can get something out of this. And it's a very important point, because it's a point that I believe a lot of the North American church in particular, but the Western church in general, misses something really huge here. And I think there's a lot of sin that happens even within the realm of church, because we've either misunderstood or just said, "I don't want to hear it," and walked away from it and not obeyed and listened to it. So let's start here in verse 27. He said, "You've heard it said." Now what Jesus is talking about, he's referring back to the Old Testament. So he's speaking to a group of Jews here. It's in the Sermon on the Mount. He's speaking to a large group of Jews that are sitting on this hillside by the Sea of Galilee. And when he says, "You've heard it said," he's referring back to two passages in the Old Testament. Exodus chapter 20 and Deuteronomy chapter 5. And in both of those, you have a list of the Ten Commandments. And in Exodus chapter 20, verse 14, and Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 10, you get the one commandment. It says, "You shall not commit adultery." Well, for the thousands of years leading from that point up until Jesus had come, is a couple thousand years, that had meant don't actually commit the physical act of adultery with somebody that's not your spouse. Don't cheat on your spouse. That's where it landed. That's how they lived it. That's what it meant. So as long as you never crossed that line and committed the act with somebody else in relationship, you're good. You're set. Nothing else to worry about. And see, one of the great misunderstandings about what Jesus did, some of us look at grace and we approach it as Jesus took the Old Testament laws and did away with them, so now we're kind of free to do whatever we want and we've got grace, right? But see, Jesus did just the opposite. He took the Old Testament law and he made it harder, because he applied something Jeremiah wrote about. In Jeremiah 31, 33, don't turn there, it's going to be on the screen. It says, "But this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people." So what Jesus was doing was fulfilling Jeremiah chapter 31, that you've had this law written on stone, with the Ten Commandments and Moses and all of that, and you had the law that was written down that the Pharisees and the Sadducees tried to enforce, but what God prophesied through the prophet Jeremiah and what Jesus was applying here and fulfilling here was that law was not going to any longer be just words on a page, but it was going to be something written in your heart that affects how you live your life. And that and no longer is the law judging just your actions, But now the law is going to judge your motives. The law is going to judge not just how you act physically, but it's going to judge how you think. And that's a lot bigger thing because, you know, technically under the law, you could plan through a murder or whatever and never be convicted of murder, but there's another place in this passage that says that if you have hate for somebody, you've committed murder already in your heart. So Jesus is taking this Old Testament law, and instead of us being required to follow a list of rules, and as long as we follow that list of rules, we're okay, he's saying God is more concerned with your heart than he is about your activities, because if the heart's right, the activities will follow. And God's more concerned with having our hearts than he is with just following a list of rules. And we as the church are really good at rules. The church is really good about do this, don't do that. There's a list of things here that Baptists aren't allowed to do, but there's a few other ones that Pentecostals can do these that we can't, but they can't do other things that we can. And then you've got all the denominations, they just all go through all these different things, and there's all different lists of rules for each denomination, and God's saying the rules are not the point. The point is I want your heart. And if I have your heart, I will lead you and guide you as to what I meant by the rules of the Old Testament. So yeah, there's a grace thing in there that the rules apply differently, but it's actually a lot harder because we can't get away with as much under this system because it's about our heart. So what he by establishing that, he said, you've heard it said this, and in verse 28, but. So they're going, yeah, I knew that, and I've never done it. I've never committed adultery because I'm that good a guy. He says this, but I say to you, everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery in her heart. And there's probably more than one person in that crowd that went, oh, I may have done that. I may have done that. So let's look at the term looks. He says, everyone who looks at a woman, the definition, the Bible definition of the Greek word that Jesus used means to perceive with attention. It's a constant stare, a dwelling look. And the idea of it's a purposeful action with the purpose of lust. It's not like a passing glance. It's not an accidental noticing something. It's you notice something, and then you stuck with it. You dwelled on it. You stared on it. Stared at it. You started processing in your mind different ideas and different thoughts. And this is what we've got to understand. We look at sin one of two ways. We see a temptation sometimes as sin, that if I feel a temptation towards something, that means I've sinned. That's not what Jesus is saying. Or we look and say, well, as long as I don't actually do it, I haven't sinned. That's not what Jesus is saying. The temptation's not the sin. Jesus was tempted. Jesus was tempted. Matthew chapter 4, we see Satan taking Jesus around the temple, around Jerusalem, and then up on a hill, and he offers him, he had been fasting for 40, hadn't had anything to eat for 40 days. And Satan says, make some bread. You're God, you can make bread. Takes him up to the temple and says, jump from the temple, you're God, the angels will save you. Takes him to the mountain and says, look, I can give you all of this. Just bow down to me. See, Jesus being completely human was tempted by those things. There was part of his humanity that was hungry, that probably thought, bread sounds good. I haven't had anything to eat in a month and a half. Bread sounds good. There was something in his humanity that thought on the side of the temple, I'm going to prove you wrong. If I jump off here, it'll prove you wrong. There's something in his humanity that saw the kingdoms of the earth and wanted to be in charge. In Hebrews, it said that Jesus was tempted in every way that we are, but he didn't sin. So he was tempted with lust. He was tempted with stealing. He was tempted with hate. He was tempted with all of these things, but he never sinned. So we have to understand that the temptation is not the sin. Because the enemy will attack you with that. The enemy will throw up temptations for whatever it is that your sin that you deal with. Maybe it's lust. Maybe it's something else in your life, lying or gossiping or whatever it is. Satan's going to throw up the temptation in front of you. And a lot of us get defeated because we think if I'm tempted, that means I've sinned. But it's not that. And it's also not that once you, we've covered this already, but that it's not that as long as I don't actually do the thing, I haven't sinned yet. Now, there's somewhere in between where you and I make a decision that we have the temptation and we feel the temptation and we have to make a choice. And the choice is to either run away from the temptation and get out of our lives or to give in. And that is where sin happens. Because see, if you give in and you actually commit the act, if you actually give in and commit to whatever it is you're dealing with, in this particular instance, it's adultery. If you give in and commit to that thing, to that relationship outside of the bounds of marriage, if you give in to that, that means at some point you made a decision to give in to a temptation. And that's when the sin happens. So we have to understand the look. When he says looks, he's not saying that you were walking through the mall and a pretty girl walked by in a skimpy outfit and you saw it. That's not the sin. The sin is when you see it and you go, I want to look at more. He's not saying the sin is when you can be honest, gluttony's a sin. And Golden Corral is really bad about it. Places like that. Can be honest, I kind of struggle with that. That there's a lot of food, I'm going to eat as much as I possibly can until I can't, literally cannot put another bite in my mouth. And that's sin. The temptation is not seeing the food and thinking, I want as much as the cake and the cookies as I can. The temptation is when we make the decision to start doing it. That's when the sin happens. Sin begins when you make the decision. So let's keep reading there. See, everyone that looks lustfully, looks at a woman that consciously makes a decision to cast his eyes and to keep his gaze on a woman with lust. So what's lust? The Greek word used for lust here is to desire or to yearn for. Interestingly, that same word, it's epithemio, is used in 1 Timothy chapter 3, talking about pastors and deacons. He says, if anyone desires to be an overseer, if anyone desires to be a deacon, he desires a good thing. That same word desire is the same word that Jesus is using here for lust. It's when you look at something, when you look at someone with desire for it, that you want that. And if it's not your spouse, it's sin. It means if you're not married yet, you don't have a spouse, it's sin. Jesus said that lust is a sin. It's a verb, it's not a thing. It's a, you kind of get the idea of that with lust, it means that we have something, but it actually is an action. It's an active thing that you are choosing to do. And I want to take a moment and make this point that too often we relegate lust to only refer to men looking at women. And that's the point that Jesus is making here. He's saying, if you look lustfully at a woman, you've already committed adultery. But let's talk about different ways that women can lust as well. Women, you're not free from this. Anything that you're yearning or desiring for from someone other than your spouse is lust. That includes physical lust, but it can also include emotional lust. How often have you heard a wife say about some other man, I just wish my husband was more like him because he does this certain thing. That you desiring something out of somebody who's not your spouse. And that's sin. How often do women in the church get wrapped up in novels and books and shows and different things because they see somebody on a screen or on a page that fulfills something in their life that their spouse, they don't feel like fulfills, and they desire it and they yearn for it and they go after it. That's lust that he's talking about there. If you turn to somebody other than your spouse for that conversation because this guy at work just listens to me better than my husband does. When you pursue that, when you desire that, when you yearn for that, that's what Jesus is talking about here. It's not just checking people out. It's looking to a spouse. And same for men. Men, you can cheat on your spouse in this way without even looking at someone physically. If there's somebody in your life that's a woman, a friend outside of your marriage that you lean on and rely on for something that you don't get from your spouse, that's outside of God's will, outside of God's plan. God has equipped your spouse to be the person that God will meet your needs through. And understand this, if you look to your spouse to meet all your needs, they're going to fail you. That's something Jane and I talk about in our marriage class that we do all the time. If you're looking to your spouse to meet your emotional needs, to be the one to listen to you all the time, husbands, to meet your physical needs, to be the one that's going to meet that need for you all the time, if you're looking for your spouse to meet any kind of need in your life, whatever it is, if you're looking for them and you're relying on them, they will let you down. And you will be tempted to go find it from somebody else. But the truth is that God is the one that supplies, the meets all the needs in our lives. And if your relationship with Jesus, if you pursue that relationship with Him through His Word, through prayer, through fellowship, if you spend time chasing after God, He will meet those needs. He will fulfill you. You will be content in relationships. And most of the time, He will use your spouse to meet that need. But if your spouse does not come through, you have to understand that God is the source of your contentment and your happiness. So if you turn to someone other than your spouse to meet any need, physical, mental, emotional, you're lusting after that person. So we've thoroughly established that all of us have probably done this at least once in our lives. All of us have. It's a very high standard that Jesus sets for us. So what do we do? How do we correct it? First, purify your desires. Purify your desires. And here's the key phrase, appetite leads to action. See, if you have an appetite for something, for that physical relationship, for that emotional relationship, if your appetite is for that thing outside of your spouse and then providing it for you, that leads to the action of following through and committing the act. So if you can step back and make sure that your desires are for the right things, your desires are for godly things and for holy things and for purity and for that relationship with Him above all else, if your desires are in the right place, then your actions will flow out of that in the right place. If your actions, if you keep doing things that disappoint yourself, if you keep doing things that feel like sin and like failing, take a moment and step back and see where your desires are. Because your actions come from your desires. And if you can purify your desires, then you can move forward with your actions. Leo Tolstoy, you heard the author, Leo Tolstoy, he's a Russian author, he wrote Anna Karenina, some other things. Late in his life, he had a conversion experience, and he said this, 5 years ago, faith came to me. I believed in the doctrine of Jesus, and all my life was suddenly changed. I ceased to desire that which previously I had desired. And on the other hand, I took to desiring what I had never desired before. That which formerly used to appear good in my eyes appeared evil. And that which used to appear evil appeared good. Turn with me to the book of Ezekiel, chapter 36. Hold your place there in Matthew 5, and turn with me to the book of Ezekiel. Chapter 36. Ezekiel is not one that we spend a lot of time in. If it's not too far back in the Old Testament. If you find Isaiah or Jeremiah, keep going closer to the New Testament. If you start running to the minor prophets, you get a bunch of little books all together, but Ezekiel is the last of the big books of the Old Testament. Ezekiel chapter 36. I'll give you just a minute to turn there. Ezekiel 36, starting in verse 24. God says, "For I will take you from the nations, gather you from all the lands, and bring you into your own land. Then I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you will be clean. I will cleanse you from all your filthiness and from all your idols. Moreover," listen to this, "I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you. And I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes, and you will be careful to observe my ordinances. You will live in the land that I gave to your forefathers, so you will be my people, and I will be your God." And see again there, God says to them, he said in Jeremiah, he says in Ezekiel, "You will be my people, and I will be your God." God's desiring your heart and a relationship with Him. Just like in Jeremiah, he's concerned about that relationship, that change. In Ezekiel, he's talking here about taking out a heart of stone, putting in a heart of flesh, so that you will be his and he will be yours. See, when we as Christians get baptized, it symbolizes a change that's happened in your life. Paul said it this way: the old have come, a new creation. The old has passed away, and the new has come. When we get baptized, we go down in the water, symbolizing death to who we were. We rise again and resurrect, mimicking the resurrection of Christ, but also symbolizing that change in your heart, that when you come out of that water, you're a different person than you were before. You've taken on the nature of Christ. I love this example and this illustration. Jane and I, we planted a garden this year, and some of our things are going pretty well. We've gotten a handful of tomatoes and some other stuff, but the one thing that's like taken off is cucumbers. Like we picked out like 15 cucumbers like in one day. It went forever doing nothing. All of a sudden, it's just like cucumbers. So we decided to make some pickles, which is really kind of fun. If you haven't done it before, it's actually kind of fun. And so we took our cucumbers and chopped them up, and then we got all different ingredients. We got onions and garlic and jalapenos and peppers and all these different stuff, and we shoved it in a bottle with the vinegar and water and the cucumbers and stuff. So a few days later, we go to eat our pickles, our cucumbers. And guess what? The cucumber, it's not the same. And that word baptizo that we used, that we got our word baptized from, it's actually from a recipe for making pickles that was written 200 years before Christ. That a Greek man wrote down a recipe for pickles, and the word that he used for when we stick the cucumber in the brine and let it set there and soak up the brine is baptizo. And that's the picture that we get painted. When we get baptized, the picture is you come out of the baptism, you come out of this new change in your life, a different person than you were before. And that's what Jesus is telling us here, that we have to understand that we're not the same person you were. So purify your desires, and that means that God is changing your heart. And if you have a relationship with Christ, if you made that decision to follow him, he's already done it. You just have to keep pursuing it in your life. Following him, listening to him, getting in a relationship with somebody who's further along with you are, and letting them help you grow in your relationship with him. That heart of stone is gone, and our new heart a flesh is put in. You have different desires now. At least you should. And if you don't, get on your knees before God and ask for them. Because God will help you have new desires. Desires for good things. For holy things. And once those desires are changed, the actions will follow suit. Secondly, firstly, purify your desires. Second, discipline your actions. And the key phrase here to remember is deal decisively with sin. Go back to the book of Matthew chapter 5. Matthew 5 verse 29. Right after Jesus says this, let me read them in context here, from verse 27. You've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out. Throw it from you, for it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. Verse 30, if your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you, for it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than your whole body to go into hell. Deal decisively with sin. If there's a temptation in your life that keeps coming back and keeps coming back, if it's an activity, if it's a person, if it's a thing, if it's the internet, if it, whatever it is in your life that temptation keeps creeping up, do something about it. Separate yourself from it. Because the fate of your soul is at stake. And the fate of somebody else's soul who's watching you is at stake. And Jesus says, it's a big deal that we deal with our sin. And if we are in a spot where I'm okay with my sin because I've got Jesus' grace, I wonder if you actually understand what grace is. God sacrificed his son to free us from the bounds of sin, from the slavery of sin. But it's up to us to take the steps necessary to keep ourselves free from sin. And it starts with disciplining our actions. And this whole concept of adultery, the way Jesus talks about it, is rampant among Western Christians. A lot of professing Christians are okay with some of these sins, or they just don't talk about it too much. But sin never occurs without some action or thought that make the possibility of giving in to sin more likely. There's no sin you commit that you didn't make a decision some point in the past that made it easier for you to get to the point of sin. So deal with that. Deal with the issues that start you down that path. You have to take drastic actions to change the situation around you. If there's a person that gets you off the path, that when you're around that person, you struggle with whatever sin it is in your life, you struggle with gossiping, you struggle with lying, you struggle with stealing, you struggle with whatever it is in your life, and that person is always a part of it, you need to have some separation there. If there's a time of the day where you're alone with your thoughts and you're alone with a computer or a TV or whatever it is, and that gives you the opportunity to fall into sin and fall into lust and fall into these different things, then take action to make sure that there's some accountability. You're not alone, or that somebody else has access to your computer or whatever it is you got to take. There's great software that will send your internet search history to somebody so they can see it. Take action to make sure that these decisions that you make along the way get you closer to God and not deeper into sin. Because it's the motivation, it's your heart. That's the issue. When you decide to sin, you've sinned, whether you could go through with it or not. But when you decide to pursue it, you've sinned. So purify your desires. Discipline your actions. And the bigger part of what we're talking about here is the idea of progressive sanctification. It's a big kind of seminary term for the idea that God is working in your life continually to make you more and more like Jesus. There's two concepts that we believe in as Christians, justification and sanctification. Justification is that point where Jesus saves you from your sin, that you're justified before God, that you're no longer held accountable for your sin. Some people have used the phrase, it's just as if I'd never sinned, but that's not really accurate, because what actually happened, that the punishment for your sin, the consequence of your sin, they didn't just go away. Jesus bore them on the cross for you. And you stand justified because of what he did for you on the cross. And then there's this idea of sanctification. That's a one-time thing, the justification. One time, it's done in the past. It has continuing results all throughout eternity that you're saved once you're justified. And not everybody in this room probably has ever experienced that. Maybe you're trying to handle the sanctification before you actually got to justification. You're at this idea of sanctification, which is where your life has changed and God is chipping away and chiseling away things in your life that make you look more and more like Jesus. And he's causing circumstances and he's bringing people into your life that make you holier, that make you more mature as a believer, that you're walking through things, you understand who God is better, you know him better, you're better with your knowledge of Scripture, you're better with your prayer life and all these things. That's your sanctification. That's a process that goes on and on and on and on until you die. But too many people in the church, they start working on the sanctification. They start working on, I got to be a better person. I got to follow the rules better. I got to make better decisions. But you've never experienced the justification. So I've got two challenges this morning. The first one is for those of you, you've never experienced the change. You've still got the heart of stone and you're trying to write the law on a heart of stone. But Jesus, Ezekiel said it, prophesied it, and Jesus has carried it out that's not the way it works anymore. Allow God to remove that heart of stone and put on the heart of flesh, and let your desires and your motives be desires and those that pursue God. And secondly, for those of you who already are saved, you're justified, but you're dealing with sin and you're struggling in it, let me encourage you. Because maybe you've blown it. Maybe you've gone too far. Maybe you've committed the sin already. And you maybe it's not even an idea of my heart. It's not even an idea of deciding to sin. I've done it. I've crossed the line. Your story's not over. John Newton, have you ever heard John Newton? He was a slave trader. back in the 1700s, 1800s. He's from England, he's a slave trader, and he would dealt with transferring slaves from Africa to England and Africa to America, and he was brutal. Brutal. He was known for mistreating and raping people, women and young girls. But God saved him. And he didn't fix it completely. He got saved and he changed. He got out of the thing. He got out of the slave trade, but he still dealt with his anger issues and his sexual temptations. And he still dealt with that and he still fell a couple more times. And then he sat down and he wrote a song because God really changed his life and he got out of it, became one of the abolitionists, became ones that led England to getting out of slavery altogether, and that led to America getting out of slavery altogether. And he sat down and he wrote a song and he said, "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound. Saved a wretch like me." Guarantee you, he's done more bad things than you did. And he said, "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see." God changed his life. And this is what he said. He wrote this as well. "I am not what I ought to be. I am not what I wish to be. I am not what I hope to be. But by the grace of God, I'm not what I was." That's where a lot of us are today. To take stock and understand that God's still working on you. And maybe you still deal with the temptation. You still deal with the decision to sin. God's not done with you yet. God's still working in your life. And there's still opportunities for God to use you. But you have to make the decision to desire the things that God wants you to desire. To desire that relationship with Him. To pursue intimacy with Him. And as you do that, He will supply your needs. He will supply all the things you need to feel content in your life. Avoid sin. Cut it out. Deal with it in your life. And you'll be better off for it. Everybody would stand. I want to pray. I have a closing song. And if you need to deal with